On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once there was slow talk and silence, then letters delivered by horse or sailing ship, months in coming, deep in thought. Then telegraph, telephone, cell phone, email, Palm Pilot, BlackBerry, texting, instant messaging, and now Twitter. Non-stop instant communication from anywhere all the time. Hyperconnectivity always present in a non-stop global mindshare of twittering microthoughts. Hungry, love duck, doing dishes, off to bed. We're pushing deeper into the seamless cyber mind. Are we happy now? Up next on Point, Twitter and the hyperconnected culture. We've got a lot of great voices and minds joining us today. With us first from San Francisco is Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter. The service was launched about a year ago by Obvious Corp, a San Francisco startup. It now hosts a torrent of tweets every day from nonstop Twitterers around the world. Jack Dorsey, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be here.
We'll have people who are probably, hip-deep, knee-deep in your service already and others who know nothing about it. Describe for us, if you would, Jack, as one example of this new hyper-connected culture we're moving into. What Twitter is, how it works.
Well, Twitter is constantly asking the question, sometimes unknowingly so, what are you doing? And you answer that question on your cell phone, you answer it on IM, you answer it on the web, and then that is sent out to all your friends who are interested in receiving your updates on their cell phones or on their IM or on their website.
140-something character limit on the messages, so these are just little tiny mini bursts of information. I'm having lunch. I'm off to bed. I just see here something from the UK. I'm breathing lilies of the valley. Something from Wisconsin. I had a nervous breakdown last night. Here's one from China. Eat, eat, eat. Just that simple.
Yes. The constraint is very important to us because it allows the update to be more off the cuff and in the moment. Instead of a traditional blog post, which is more composed, and you're required to be more of a better writer and really consider your audience. Eating a taco is just as valid as any other update on Twitter.
We'll talk about the kind of information that gets communicated, but make it very clear for us what's different here. I mean, you can send a little email anytime you like. You can post to a blog anytime you like. So the difference with Twitter is the thing that makes it more micro-oriented and makes it new?
Well, the biggest difference is that it's also in real time, and it's going to your pocket. When you receive an update from your friend, your phone buzzes. So it's a little bit more tangible, their activity, and you're feeling that motion in real time.
When did you launch it, and how many people are using it? What's the growth been like?
We started working on March 13th of last year, and we launched it officially in August of last year, August 2006. That was our first full month. And we've been growing, we've been doubling the number of users and number of updates every 2 weeks now. So growth has been pretty much exponential and taken off.
So you're on the hockey stick, as they like to say.
We are on the hockey stick, yeah. Good place to be.
Right. And here I'm looking at, somebody who's put this up on Google at the same time. So you can watch these messages pop up from all over the world. Here's somebody saying from actually, in my backyard, Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm on eBay. And then there's somebody else here in New York spotting Tim Robbins last night. And then here's somebody else on the coast saying business as usual. Posts from Japan, from China. Here's something from Brazil. How you doing? I mean, what is the point of this exactly? Dentist office right next door to having a smoke is one from Chicago here. What's the point again, Jack?
Well, the point is connection. This is small talk, and it's things you normally would not tell people, but it provides a context for your life. Like just eating breakfast is something that in your day-to-day life you would not normally tell someone, but it's something we all do, so it's a connection point that we all share. And it's very interesting for me to see that my friend in England is going to bed as I'm waking up to eat my donut.
The New York Times looked at this and was reminded of E.M. Forrester, who wrote, of course, Only Connect, and they asked if this might be more connectivity than anybody could possibly need. I mean, where does this take us? What are we getting into? Is this a kind of nervous system where we know not only what we see and feel around us, but we know, I don't know, what's going on in our circle globally all the time?
It really depends on what you make of it and how you listen to it. It's very much writing on the wall for many people, and it's who chooses to look at that wall and interpret it. So you can turn as much of it on or off as you wish.
It's kind of amazing. You can see these popping up at twittervision.com, where someone has overlaid all these tweets with a Google map of the world, and it's just popping and hopping all over the place. A heartthrob knows these things, comes one right now from San Francisco. Here's one right this minute. If anyone knows any MT gurus, I'd love to have one. Here's something from the UK. I need something on schools and power lines and just, you know, pop, pop, pop from around the world. We're going to hear some insights on this from around the country in this hour. Let's want to hear from our listeners as well. Let's take a call right now from Chesapeake, Virginia. Jay, what do you think?
I think that we are all becoming Borg, and those who follow Star Trek: The Next Generation will understand. I am like Hugh. I don't need to be connected with the collective. I'm happy alone with my thoughts. I don't need my hand held electronically over the airwaves.
Now, Star Trek and Borg, the Borg was the creatures who were all part of one big communal mind, and that's just the way they operate. You saying no thanks?
No thanks. I'm like Hugh. He's the one that...
the one breakout guy. The rebel.
Exactly.
Jack Dorsey, that's a pretty big diss. You're building Borg here to tie us all into one kind of tyranny of mind. What do you say?
Well, I think Twitter is best when you limit it to your circle of friends. So if your circle of friends is the Borg, then you're going to have some issues potentially. But you can choose to go into a greater whole. But the main point is to connect your friends, connect your family, and just have a greater context for what's going on in their life.
Here's one from Czechoslovakia. Bought pair of sunglasses. Do we need to know? Well, no, but now we do. Somebody bought a pair of sunglasses. Kate's calling from Holliston, Massachusetts. Kate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering if the gentleman, I'm sorry, I missed his name.
Jack
or
Dorsey.
You would like to just comment on the relationship between narcissism and this very tiny soundbite type of communication. I feel like in our society we're dangerously going away from nuanced writing and nuanced speech, and this sort of thing kind of scares me, but maybe that's just because I'm 44, so I'm not used to it.
Twitter and narcissism, we'll pick it right up. What do you say, Jack Dorsey? Is this a kind of complete self-absorption? I'm reading here from somebody last night, these different posts, too tired to do dishes, feeling happy, cursing dial-up after stopping download. Is this narcissism?
I don't know if it's narcissism. I think it could be if you take it that way. I also think it could be just a way to get something out quickly. I think we all have a need to express feelings and communication, and I think this is a very low barrier to entry. So yes, it could be taken as some self reflection. It could also be shown as wanting to connect to your circle of friends.
E.M. Forster spinning in his grave or celebrating. We'll see. Jack Dorsey in San Francisco, stand by for a moment. I want to go to Phoenix, Arizona, and Robert Scoble. He's a Twitter enthusiast who now has 3,240 friends and about as many followers who follow his every Twitch and tweet via Twitter. He's a former Microsoft blogger, well-known tech guru, and now posts at podtech.net and scobalizer.com. Robert Scoble, thanks for being with us.
Hey, it's great being here.
You've been quoted saying that among the digitati, there are all kinds of feelings about this, a lot of buzz about it at where the digital elite gather, but you've also said that Twitter hate is now the new black. It's everywhere. why do you love it? Why is it now suddenly also so widely hated?
I think people see it and they have a visceral reaction to it. You know, if they don't see anybody that they know on it, they think it's the lamest thing they've ever seen. And then if they start seeing some of their friends on it, then they start turning. I mean, I had that experience. When I first saw it, I said, I'm not going to join that. Not another thing I have to join and waste my time on. But then a lot of my friends started joining on it, and it started becoming much more interesting to me. And now that I have, you know, hundreds of people I know personally on it, and then, you know, several thousand people who just are following me, and I'm following them because of my blog popularity, It's really interesting because I can go on there and ask the world a question, and somebody gets back to me. And you know, on my friends list are CEOs of major companies, and journalists around the world. And here I'm at a conference this week, and I would say 30 to 40% of the people at Venture Capital Conference are on Twitter and are part of my friends list. So you can really keep in touch with some really interesting people this way.
And people you don't even know. I mean, I'm looking here again at twittervision.com. Here's from Fairbanks, Alaska, did housework yesterday. From somewhere in South Africa, valuation deadline in shambles. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I mean, what's the point of knowing all this?
Well, if it's your friends or your mom or your brother, it helps sort of keep in touch in a loose way so that I don't need to call them up and say, hey, you know, what are you doing?
Jack Dorsey's with us from San Francisco. I want to go right now to Washington, D.C., and Rob Peguerrero, personal technology columnist for The Washington Post and a good friend of ours. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Put this in some context for us. Is Twitter out on a limb here, or is this where, you know, the front edge of technology is now going, the nonstop global nervous system, mind, call it what you will? What's pushing forward here, Rob?
I think it's kind of an extension of what people already do with their MySpace pages and their Facebook pages, where you're sort of broadcasting the details of your life in the hope that strangers will find it interesting and I guess certainly in the trust that your friends and family will find it interesting.
And so you've got one example in Twitter. There's, of course, there's Dodgeball. Remind us what that is. That's kind of ballpark.
Yeah, that's the cell phone networking service.
So you know where people, not only what they're up to, but where they are. Are they near me now? That sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
And what about, you know, it was a decade and more now, John Perry Barlow had his Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. And, you know, the sort
right,
of big
yes, yes.
Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. But the point was, he said there, cyberspace consists of transactions, relationship, and thought itself arrayed like a standing wave in the web of our communications. Ours is a world that is both everywhere and nowhere. You know, beyond all limits, we will create a civilization of the mind in cyberspace. May it be more humane and fair than the world, et cetera, et cetera. Is that where we're coming here, Rob Peguerrero, or is it burp, I just had a taco?
I think it's all of the above. If you look at some of these things on Twitter, yeah, some of them, it's unclear why you would put that online. But I guess if once you're in the habit of dumping the daily details of your life online, why not throw everything up there? Yeah.
So does but the question is, does it amount to just everything up there, or a kind of new realm of perception that makes us bigger than the physical space we live in? I mean, can we handle that? Are we wired for that? Does it make us greater or lesser? I want to bring one more voice in here, if I may, from Los Angeles.
Sure.
Holly Willis joins us. She is professor of media studies at the University of Southern California, associate director of the Institute for Multimedia Literacy at USC, author of The New Ecology of Things, a book coming out next month on cutting-edge computer networking trends. Holly Willis, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What are we growing here? Are we growing a sort of hypermind beyond our own, a new nervous system, or just, you know, a lot of chaff?
Well, I think it's a reflection of a culture that wants to be networked, that wants to be connected. And I think the tools that we're talking about are very social. And I think that they grow out of the culture that we're part of, a computer-based culture. So, and also a culture that's intensely surveilled. We are living at a time when everything we do is chronicled and documented, whether it's credit card purchases or checking out books at the library or medical records. So one response is to sort of be more public, to actually pose in front of this kind of surveillance camera. And this kind of activity where you're documenting the turkey sandwich that you had for lunch is a really kind of flippant response to that in some ways, and I think it's really fascinating for that reason.
So a part of it is being surveilled, a willingness to be surveilled. I mean, more than that, a kind of eagerness to be surveilled. But I wonder, Holly, if you see in people who are really tied into this a new understanding of what the world is around them. And we saw, what was it, earlier this month, the BlackBerry system went down in part of the country for a little while, and people freaking out, just couldn't stand being cut off from their twitching BlackBerry habit for, you know, 20 minutes. Reports coming out, what was it, last summer from, I think it was Rutgers, saying the BlackBerry addiction is similar to drugs. There's an addiction angle, but there's a perception angle, Holly. Can people live where they are and everywhere else a friend happens to be effectively all at the same time?
Well, I think, as was mentioned earlier, it's really what you make of it. I think that we're not all reading all of this all the time. We're reading specific things that apply to our own lives and things that kind of activate and contribute to what we're doing. So in that sense, no, I'm not going to read everything that comes along. I'm going to sort of really take what's there and make what I can of it. And I think that's really part of what all of this is about. It's participatory media where you are taking things and shaping it and contributing and participating in a very active way. And I think for social networks, especially among younger people who use these tools a lot, this is really it really grows into a part of their identity, and they do feel cut off when they don't have it. And I think there are analogies that, you know, you can look at it at for other generations, but I think it's a really active part of that social network, and it's also very much a part of identity construction. Who we are now is often based on how we construct ourselves in these networks. How do we portray ourselves? And often those portraits are of mundane sort of minutiae. Sometimes they're fictions, but that's all part of a larger kind of construct of selfhood that I think is really part of being alive right now.
Mm. This just in from Michigan on the big Twitter screen, eating yummy vegan pancakes. Nina's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Nina, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Well, I had a couple of responses listening, and the first thing that popped into my mind is, my God, everybody is so damn lonely, that this is a way to be in touch, however technical it is. It's a kind of craving for a closeness that to some degree people can't even tolerate. Maybe they're actual people they're around, they don't want to be that close to them, but it's creating a culture of synthetic closeness. There's also another aspect that struck my mind. It's like we're turning into a kind of a mini performance society. All these technical things enable people to be in touch by and put on a tiny little performance. I mean, it's beyond, was it Andy Warhol who said, my 15 right. minutes of fame? Now it's my 2 seconds of Twitter.
Right, but a constant stream of those 2 seconds.
A constant stream, and I don't know if people will drown in it or thrive in it or ignore most of it. So it'll become like advertising that you just tune it out. But it's a need of, to me, the first thing I thought of is, like, people are lonely.
I want to ask you about your phrase. It's a wonderful one, synthetic closeness. Is it really synthetic, or is that just a matter of perspective and opinion? If I know, I mean, eating right now, eating wonderful chocolate cake, it said here in Deutschland on the map. Is that, I mean, if I know that my friend is eating that chocolate cake, is that a synthetic closeness, synthetic awareness, or just
no,
an extended awareness?
Where it's an awareness, and it's a shared awareness, and it's, even if you don't know is it people you know, okay, so you share it in that flicker of your mental attention. But you're not in the same room with them. You can't taste it. You can't see it. So it's distanced. Everything, what I mean synthetic, it's not that it's phony. It's just everything is distanced, and people aren't really in community relationships.
Red Bull, what a pleasure, it says from Milan in Italy. Jack Dorsey, are you creating synthetic closeness here or just extended intimacy closeness?
I would say extended intimacy closeness. I think it's a matter of where the emphasis lies. Do you emphasize the technology to bring this together, or do you emphasize the message? And my hope is that the message is more emphasized. And like when you see someone is eating a chocolate cake, that brings you closeness, even though you are across the country or across the world.
And Holly Willis in Los Angeles, what about this idea that everyone's life in this kind of arena becomes a mini performance, a nonstop mini performance, because, as you say, we are surveilled. So in a way, people are always on stage, or is that an old-fashioned way of looking at it?
No, I think that's very true. I think there is a desire for that kind of performativity, and I think you can take it even further. There are people doing things called life logging, where they're actually chronicling their entire lives by wearing around a camera and things like that. And I think that's also, again, comes out of the technologies that are around us. We live in a time when there are databases and computational abilities of the computer. So how do you respond to that? Well, you start to construct your own self as a database of all of this information, and then you can kind of build something out of that. So I don't think the technology determines us, but I think that it really contributes to the kinds of metaphors and paradigms that we then organize our lives by.
When we're always, always on. Barack Obama finally used his Twitter account earlier today, says somebody in Oklahoma right now. Leslie's calling from Groton, Massachusetts. Leslie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment is that I think in the past generation or two, we've moved away from our communities geographically.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of am happy to see an innovative return to connectedness, and I think it remains to be seen how it will completely evolve, but, you know, one caller called it loneliness. I think in another way it's just a newfangled reaching out for each other, and I'm not unhappy to see it.
And it's easy in some ways to be sympathetic with that, Leslie. I mean, once we got the power to travel, people flew apart from one another and for centuries just lived with that. Now you can be physically apart but still together. I guess that can be a laudable intimacy.
Well, I think it's an innovative way to regain a sense of connectedness even in the mundane day-to-day acts, you know, of our life. I used to call my sister when I was doing the dishes, and we were doing the dishes together, even though she was in Hong Kong and I was in Massachusetts. And so if Twitter is another way to do that, why not? Why not do it?
Yeah. Leslie, I love it. Ollie Willis, how about it? Many years ago, as a young man, I moved to Hong Kong and, of course, then didn't see or hear from family for months at a time, and some not years. Are we going to look back on that as a kind of barbaric period of apartness that gets solved by living simultaneously wherever we are, plus with everybody we care about?
No, I think that's exactly right, that this allows us to be really present with our families and friends as we're more dispersed geographically. We're able to really be present, and I think that idea of being present, of being there rather than sort of disappearing or being absent, is really important to people, and I think that's why Twitter is so powerful. It really lets people feel that kind of presentness. Again, among a group that, you know, you feel important or connected to, it also then makes you public to lots of other people and chance kind of connections. But I think for being present to your family, being present to your friends as we're more dispersed, it's one of the keys to what makes us so powerful.
Hey, and I just saw our show up in a tweet from Seattle. Tom Ashbrook on point on Twitter. We're in the global nervous system. Let's get a call from Gardner, Massachusetts. Claire, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up the fact that, from what I see, it's mostly young people that use these new technologies. And I'm talking about constantly being on the cell phone or messaging with their friends, on break from work or if they're waiting in line at the store. This stops them from meeting people, particularly people of the older generation, which I guess I am. And I just think it cuts off people from that kind of socializing or that kind of just a casual conversation, and it separates us more.
But if they weren't if they weren't in the grocery line, you know, Twittering with somebody in Kalamazoo, do you really think they'd turn to you and have a significant conversation, or is it even just the glance, the meeting of eyes, the standing consciously next to each other that you'd value even if nothing else happened?
I don't know if it would be a significant conversation, but certainly I start conversations with strangers. Mm-hmm. So it's just that we're experiencing the same thing at the same time, commenting on what's going on around us, commenting on what's happening in the news with people that we don't already know.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas when people are constantly connected to people they already know, they're not exposed to a different worldview. And I think particularly the generational thing is happening more and more. I see this, that the young people, they just don't get to know the older people that they work with.
Because they're living in different realms shaped by technology. It raises an interesting thing, Rob Pegoraro, let me put it to you. When you look at these new technologies all the time and how people use them, do you have a sense of humans with the kind of zero-sum consciousness, i.e., if I'm going to be more aware of people elsewhere, I'm going to be less aware of the world around me, or do we just expand the kind of portfolio of our mind to take it all in?
I think it's more the latter. I think to a certain, we've talked a little bit here about the difference between, you know, people who know you, who can use something like Twitter or Facebook, MySpace, Dodgeball, whatever, to stay in touch with you instead of having to be on the phone all the time. And the rest of the world, to a certain extent, it's sort of the anonymity of the crowd. You can do anything. You can wear anything ridiculous if you're one of 40,000 people. To the rest of the world, you're invisible, you know, except for the people right next to you. So, yeah, I don't know. I think something like Twitter, you know, when I've gone on the Twitter homepage just to see the stuff that pops up, it's just kind of idle voyeurism, I suppose, you know, and the hope that maybe I'll see something interesting or just, well, okay, everyone's as insane as I am. These are the ridiculous things on their mind at this moment.
Jack, do we lose what Leslie's worried, that she's not going to get to know the person standing next to her, is plugged into, you know, Bangkok or Bangor or somewhere? What about it? Zero sum human consciousness? If we're more extended into the world through Twitter, we're less present where we actually physically are?
I think it has the potential to bridge a lot more people. Speaking from my own experience, my entire family is on Twitter. Everyone from my mother and my father to my younger cousins. And I have a greater sense of what my cousins are doing and also my parents and how they live their lives. And I don't think I would have necessarily gone that deep into a conversation without, you know, that context. So for me, and specifically my mother, I'm traditionally bad at calling home. And now she has, and I have a way to kind of catch up with each other on a day-to-day basis. And then when we do finally have the conversation, it goes very deep, and we have a context for things to talk about. And so for me, it's just a deeper sense of connectedness. And I think that translates to strangers as well.
Because you've got a sense with your mother, in that case, of what you've been up to all along the way. Rob Pregoro, I know I got to let you go. Is there more coming on this path? Now we're down in the micro blogging. Does it get tinier, finer, quicker than this someday?
Hard to imagine, but, you know, look at how things have advanced. Most people these days, they're carrying around an object in their pocket that can get on the internet, their cell phone. So, you know, those things have cameras, they can record video. You can imagine at some point that, sure, your camera phone, assuming you have it out of your pocket, will be recording a live video stream and broadcasting out of what you're up to.
Let me go to McLean, Virginia, and Enrique. Enrique, what do you think?
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think I've grown up with this entire system. I started off when I was younger with the whole BBS systems,
yep.
Sort of like a proto internet. When you know, I was emailing back when people weren't emailing, and I've just seen it almost evolve through the time to today, where, you know, before we didn't have, when I was younger, mm-hmm. Like 15 or so, we didn't have the blue state, red state, that kind of aspects, like the division that has grown over the last decade.
You think somehow there's a relationship inverse between more connectivity and at the same time more division?
Well, like, yes, more than kind of see it as a buffet, and a lot of people see it as it's a sort of a double-edged sword. Yes, you can go ahead and use huge buffet and take a little bit of everything and taste it, but what ends up happening if you have a sort of a vertical integration of this buffet, where you don't only have chocolate and you think that you like chocolate, well, you think that choice is, you know, dark chocolate and, you know, Hawaiian chocolate or whatever, all this type of thing, you kind of just integrate and go deeper into these particular things and make yourself a little bit different from everyone else. You end up talking with everyone in your own network. I am part of Friendster. I do have mm-hmm. a MySpace account, stuff like that. And most of the time I use it to interact with my own friends, and it really does.
Do you feel enhanced and embraced by that constant connection, Enrique, or something else?
No, actually, at this point, I'm in the middle of a cubicle, and I can talk to all my friends, and yeah, that's fantastic. At a certain level, I have this hyper-connectivity and sort of almost neural jack into all my friends' heads, but it does keep me from, I don't know who the next cubicle over, and I'm really not getting to meet that person.
Right, so there's a potential downside, even while you get to carry your host of friends with you. Enrique, in Virginia, thanks for that. Here's a tweet from Utah. Sinus infection. Ugh. Evan, in Framingham, Massachusetts, what do you say?
Morning, Tom.
Hey.
I just want to, you know, say something to the naysayers that think that this is going in the wrong direction, that it's closing us off from everyone else. But if you think about it, it really is opening us up to everyone else. The whole Web 2.0 approach that allows me, someone in Framingham, Massachusetts,
yeah.
to shout out that can be seen by someone in Norway is something that's more extensive than being able to talk to someone in the grocery line.
And apart from the being able to ping somebody in Norway, what's the new realm that you're welcoming there? What's the new dynamic, Evan?
It's the ability to just express what you're experiencing at any given moment without having to sit down and compose it, like they said, like you have to do with a blog. I think it takes down the barrier of presenting a character that you end up ultimately doing, I think, with a blog. You just get to say who you are. You've only got 100 or so or 250 or so characters to present what you're doing, and you're just going to say, you know, I'm doing whatever I'm doing. The tweet that I just put up was that I'm waiting on Oracle because I'm at work right now.
And are you reading tweets of people you don't know?
Yeah, I'm watching the Twitter Vision and just getting a kick out of seeing what everyone else is going through and doing in their day to day.
Does it have meaning to you if somebody in Norway says, hey, I just had a schnitzel for lunch or something? So what?
It means a lot to me because it makes us more interconnected. It makes the world smaller, and I think in this day and age that's something that needs to happen because we're getting too far apart in other ways.
Got it. So there's a vote for the neural network reaching out from Framingham to Norway. Let's take a call from Bristol, Rhode Island, and Mildred. Hi, Mildred. You're on the air.
Hi. I hope my sister's listening and will correct me, but if I misquote, but she has a bunch of letters from the middle of the 19th century from a girl who moved from Ontario mm-hmm. to, I think it was Indiana, which is less than a day's travel for us now by car.
Yeah.
And she says that she had a baby last year. And that she knows she's never going to see her mother again, and the mother will never see the grandchildren.
Because of that, what is now a small distance.
Yeah, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I just, that sticks in my mind so much, the isolation of people. And my grandparents moved from Finland mm-hmm. at the beginning of last century and never really went home again or communicated that much with their families, and I'll bet you they would have been thrilled to be able to be, like I do with email now, connected with their family, and so easily.
Something less brutal about it. If you picture those crowds surging in through Ellis Island, talking into an earpiece to the folks back home saying, you know, they're taking my fingerprints now, Mama.
Yeah.
You're
but,
for it,
you know,
Mildred.
I do eBay, and I communicate with people all over the world.
Yeah.
And it is a wonderful, I just love it. I love to communicate with somebody in Japan or Italy or Holland. It just makes me feel closer to the world.
I hear that, and I've certainly experienced that, the distance and the separation and the pain that can bring. But let me ask you, Mildred, I mean, last week I happened to spend down in Mississippi on the Gulf Coast doing Katrina relief work. We had no media. This is out where everything was washed away by Katrina.
Oh, yeah.
We had no radio, no TV, you know, nothing going on, just shovels and hammers and wood and dirt and the people next to us with them humming or the smell of their perspiration. You know, I actually found that kind of really organic, unconnected thing extremely pleasing. And I'm not a tweeter guy, but I was reminded of how deep in the moment we can live and don't, even just with traditional media these days. I mean, do we risk losing something for that magic alchemy of reaching out to people far away all the time?
But you were down with people you didn't know, and you were connecting not just at your office or someplace else, but this was a new experience, and it was new to them, and you were connecting with them at the same time. And I really think it's good to have both, and I don't see anything wrong with connecting with people in the world as long as you don't obsess about it and becomes the only way you
yep.
live.
Mildred, you've got a wonderful, pliable mind. I think you'll prosper in this new era. Holly, I keep coming back to this question of capacity, though, and whether we have to slough off experience and consciousness that's immediate, physical, local, to gain, when we live in this river of tweets, in this case, that are global, distant, disembodied.
Well, I think it's a matter of sort of doing what Mildred does, sort of taking the tools and using them in ways that help you and kind of pushing away the things that don't really work for you and that you don't have time for. And I think one of the things that comes up all the time with these technologies is time. I don't have time for reading every Twitter that comes up. I don't have time for staying in touch with my family, so I need these tools. So I think time is really an interesting concept in all of this. And if you think about it, one of the things that Twitter does is kind of embody a new sense of time. The sense of long spans of time is being replaced by moments, like kind of flashes. And you can think of the shift from the analog clock with the sweep of the arm to the digital clock and the flash and the flash and the flash. And I think we're living in a different temporal experience, and something like Twitter embodies that, and it's up to us as people existing at this moment to kind of maneuver and use these tools in a way that, that works for us. And I think that's what makes these tools so amazing, is that we actually have the option to do that. With Twitter, there's enough malleability there that we can make it into something. It's not completely controlled from the top down. It really allows itself to be retooled depending on how people want to use it. And I think that's another part of this. We can participate, we can control it and use it in a way that makes it functional for exactly what we need.
Jack Dorsey, you co-founded this thing. What about this sense of time? I mean, think back to, I don't know, the Civil War. A loved one, a husband, probably in that case, might have died on a given day, and the family may not know for months. Now we know, you know, the flavor of ice creams somebody's having for a bedtime snack. The time has collapsed around that. Is there the capacity for us to change our interaction with time, to jam more in, to live more in each little nano sliver of time? Or are you cracking open some new relationship with time here?
Oh, definitely. I think it again is what you put into the network, and it really forces you to think about how discerning you are and how much a part of the experience you want to be. You can be in the moment, and you can cross time boundaries, of course, or you can just step away and step away for as long as you want. It's what you make of it and what you make of time and how you interpret that.
Let's go to Mary Clay in Charleston, South Carolina. Mary Clay, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
You're so welcome.
I think this is such a fascinating conversation, especially because I'm part of the Gen X generation, and I sort of grew up in the middle. I consider myself sort of a transitional person in technology. We didn't have a computer in our house until my senior year in high school.
Yep.
And it wasn't until 1997 that I had an email account at Appalachian State University, like my freshman year in college. And now I'm a college professor. And so I think it's fascinating to see my students engage in Twitter or Facebook or MySpace. And some of them have all of them. They have blogs, they have MySpace. And I think it's really fascinating because I don't know if it really diminishes or if it enhances their experience or relationships with people. But I think the question is, what does it mean that they care about people having schnitzels in Germany or that I have shrimp and grits for lunch? What does that mean?
Well, what if it's people that you know? Do you want to know what your intimate family and friends are doing all the time? Would that enhance your life if you had the, tech inclination to do it, Mary Clay?
It does. It does. But I think on some level it does enhance this notion that people are watching and that people care. And so I do think it's another tool to reach out and say, please say that my life means something. Please say that you care about me or that you want to watch me, and I'll watch you too. And that way they sort of validate their experience. And I think that the more technology, the more trouble people have in sort of validating their experience and maybe their existence. And because they're so overwhelmed with the amount of information they're bombarded with, my students in particular. And so I think they are more inclined to reach out to their family and friends using technology, Twitter, blogs.
And you say, bravo, be loved, even by tweets. Mary Clay, thanks for that. Let's get Mark in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Mark, you're on the air.
How you doing? I'm calling from the First Landing. I just wanted to call and say that I'm...
Do you mean Jamestown by that or something like that, Mark?
Virginia Beach.
Okay, good, great. What do you say?
So, I just want to call and say I'm really encouraged about all these new technologies that you can get instant information, you're always on, and learn more about just anything you want. I mean, not all knowledge is scholastical, and for me as a Christian, it's really a fulfillment of prophecy that the Bible says that towards the end times that knowledge will increase, and that's what's happening now with these technologies. So I'm in favor of them. I'm encouraged of them, and for me, it's fulfillment of prophecy.
So you say this is prophecy, knowledge will increase, so Twitter taking us closer to the rapture, Mark?
I firmly believe that because it says, when Jesus touches feet, his feet back down the Mount of Olives, that every eye will see, and the internet, I believe, will play a part in that.
Wow, we're getting cosmic right there, Mark. Thanks very much for your call. So here I am watching, tweet from France, eating chocolate covered in raisins. One from Missouri, going to wake up in Vegas. One from the UK, motorcycle decapitated in crash. Wow, some crazy haiku out there. Holly, you hear the range of response to this. People, both simultaneously wanting this many, some addicted to it, others not sure if it bleeds away from the here and now. Are we going to wake up in 50 years and simply have a different sense of space and time and intimacy on the back of all this technology that's now surrounding us, Holly?
I think we will. I think we'll have a dramatically different sense. And I think one of the things that's come up a couple of times is the difference between generations and younger generation being more attuned and able to do this easily. And that's a big generalization. As we heard from Mildred, she's online and doing things, and older people are as well. But I think that it's imperative for us to understand how this stuff works and not to just throw up our arms and kind of say, well, it's all technology and I don't want anything to do with it. But really understanding it, trying to get a sense of what's going on, because we are experiencing change and it is moving very rapidly. There's a sense of things changing dramatically. There's a kind of time-space compression almost. So I do think that things will change. And I don't think that that's a bad thing or a good thing necessarily. It's really, it's kind of up to us to help contribute to how that happens and to what we want that to be.
Wow.
And I think that's part of the ethos of the Web 2.0 technology to a certain extent, is to enable participation and to have us be empowered to help direct what's going to happen next as a community, as a group.
Well, collapsing that time and space at high speed. Jack Dorsey, if you keep growing at this pace, how long until everybody on Earth is tweeting?
A few months. I'm not sure about that. It's going to take a few years.
But exponential right now, and what an amazing picture. Well, there we go. A whole new vista and a lot of people living on it already. Pretty incredible. It's been wonderful to talk about it. I'm still watching these tweets come up on the twittervision.com map. You really should check it out. Here's something from Tokyo about Black Lagoon. Here's one from your neck of the woods, Jack. Tweet from San Francisco, I want to sail around the world. It looks like it's easy to do that, at least digitally. Jack Dorsey, co-founder of Twitter, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Holly Willis at University of Southern California, professor of media studies there. Her new book will be The New Ecology of Things. Holly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Tweet, tweet. This is On Point.